It's not just a game, it's not just a grass. Lawn Solutions Australia is the exclusive home of Australia's best sports turf varieties. For the world's best grasses like Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda and Sir Grange Zoysia, contact Lawn Solutions Australia at lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au. Hello and welcome to episode 101 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast from Golf Australia magazine, trying to answer that eternal question, what is it that draws so many to this game? My name's Rod Murray and I'm joined on the digital blower today by my colleague in this audio adventure, John Huggan. Huggy will be at the wheel for the next couple of weeks in the run-up to the Ryder Cup with a number of special guests, starting with this week's subject, 2010 US Open winner Graham McDowell. Huggy, welcome. You told me when you sent this interview through, and this is rare for you, you said you thought it was good. Why?
Yeah. Well, Graham can talk. I think he'd be the first to admit.
And you can listen. So that's a good combination.
Yes, indeed. My goodness, he can talk. I mean, it's no surprise that I think it was a few years ago now, but he won the award from the American Golf Writers for the most cooperative player. And he's a terrific. I've always liked him a lot. I played with him. Actually, I'm at Wentworth this week for the BMW PGA, and I played with Graham in the Pro-Am here at Wentworth in 2010, just 3 weeks before he won the US Open. So obviously, playing with me had a big influence. So.
I didn't know that. There you go. Yeah. I'm sure you've never let him forget it either. Can you, well, just quickly on a rabbit hole, surely he can't talk more than Harrington. That can't be possible.
I tell you what, it's close.
Neck and neck.
If you had the two of them together in the same room, I don't think you'd need anybody else there, that's for sure.
One ear for each. He's an interesting player, isn't he? He's not the quintessential modern-day touring professional.
He's not. I mean, his swing is well, he's one of those guys that you can tell from a distance who it is. It's a swing all his own. I think he's always struggled with it a bit. Technique-wise, but when he's on or when he's been on in the past, I mean, my goodness, he's been good. And he's done some great things. I mean, apart from the US Open win, I mean, he held the winning putt in the Ryder Cup. He's, you know, and won umpteen tournaments all over the place. So, and he was a college star, what everybody forgets, from nowhere, really. I mean, I think he mentions it in the podcast that he went to America as just a kind of run-of-the-mill, played for Ireland as an amateur kind of guy, one of many that, you know, that sort of level. But as soon as he got there, he just took off. Yeah. He was like number one college player in America for the, certainly some of the time. He was, I think it was Alabama.
Yes, that sounds about right. Long way from Northern Ireland to Alabama, you would think, too.
Yeah.
There's a whole podcast episode in that at some point, I reckon. What happens that you get to a certain level, some go on and some don't, and it's not always the ones you'd pick. McDowell strikes me as one of those types who's incredibly affable, but in competitive terms, will put a knife in you on the first tee just for the sport of it.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. I mean, he sounds like the nicest guy on the planet. And he's even, you know, despite the fact that the time in America has done, you know, irreparable damage to his accent, which is all over the place, as he freely admits himself. But yes, he's a bit of a killer. Yeah. On his record there, if you look at the guys that he beat down the stretch, it's like a who's who. When he was on, he was really on, and he's slipped from that level. We talked a bit about that. That was one of the reasons I think he joined the Live Golf side of things. We get into that a little bit. He was one of the guys. I think we mentioned this the press conference at the very first Live event at mm-hmm. Centurion Club near London. He was in the press conference. He got himself into all kinds of trouble trying to be nice yes. and answer the questions.
Yeah.
And he got himself into a terrible mess, which he was getting into areas he really didn't know enough about to be answering, which is true of all of us, not just him. But very honest with it. You can't help but like the guy. I mean, he's just, you know, he's just the sort of guy you'd love to sit down and have a pint with.
Yeah, indeed, which you got to do. Last thing, Huggy, of course, this next series of interviews is going to be Ryder Cup focused because the Ryder Cup is coming up, and I don't care where you are in the world, Ryder Cup is one of yeah. the great golf events. There's nobody who's uninterested in it. You pick a side no matter where you're from, and you go for it. I was really interested to hear him say, and it's the snippet I used to promote this podcast last week, that team events have been so much more important even than winning the US Open at Pebble Beach. That's an extraordinary attitude, isn't it?
I thought that too, but it's right. I mean, the Ryder Cup has done a lot to a lot of careers, not just Graham's, to elevate them to a level where they probably wouldn't have been otherwise. You know, there's a whole bunch of names you could come up with. Sam Torns being the classic example over here, who's someone who's synonymous with the Ryder Cup, but didn't actually break through at major level. So there's a few guys like that, and Graham's certainly one of them. But you're right. I mean, this is a guy who, like I said, I was shocked.
Yes.
You're a guy who won the US Open at Pebble Beach, for goodness sake.
Jack Nicklaus put that pretty high on the list. That's more true of the European Ryder Cup players than the US ones, I think, Huggy, that elevation
Yeah, it's always meant more, hasn't it? I mean, the underdog mentality, they were playing for the tour more than themselves, and the Americans – until fairly recently, certainly were playing for themselves, not the tour.
Yeah, this upcoming Ryder Cup will be fascinating. I'm sure we'll talk about it as it gets closer. But for the moment, thank you, Huggy. Let's have a listen to Graham McDowell. Appreciate you taking the time today.
My pleasure.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My latest guest is a man who's won a major championship. He's won the winning point in a Ryder Cup. He's beaten Tiger Woods in a playoff for a tournament. But amidst all that, Graham McDowell, what was and is the thing about golf for you?
Yeah, thanks, John. The thing about golf, I mean, I think it's just a quest for perfection in a game which is imperfectible. You know, I think I've always loved the solace of you and the improvement. You know, I just stand on the range the same way I stood on the range when I was 12 years old, you know, trying to find it, trying to get better. Yeah. I think it's a beautiful, nasty, delicious, difficult game, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like a microscopic view of life, you know, it's got its ups and downs every day. And, you know, you gotta wrestle with your emotions and, you know, the physical side of the game, but, you know, most importantly, the mental side of the game. So it's definitely a game which I still love to this day.
You can come up with a few different adjectives for it, can't you? You just
did. Definitely a lot of four-letter words to describe the game. You know, there's no doubt. You know, it's I think the fact that golf's a four-letter word, I think, is pretty ironic. You know, it's it definitely emotes a few of those every now and again.
Yeah, and have things that what you just described there, has that changed over the years for you? In you know, in terms of what you're thinking over the ball,
I think. I think it's always been the same. I think it's, you know, I've gone down the rabbit hole a few times trying to come up with a new way to do it. I think I've realized about myself that, you know, there only is one way that I can do it. I've always had the same swing habits. I've always had the same mental bad habits. You know, I think, you know, a leopard doesn't change its spots very much. You know, I don't think of too many world-class pro players that have been able to reinvent themselves. Mm. You know, I look at a guy like Rory. Rory's been the same golfer since he was 15.
Yeah.
You know, he's always been fast and he's always swung it great. He's always had an unbelievable short game. He looks a bit different now, but he's still the same guy.
Yeah, he's not the chubby wee kid he was before.
Yeah, you know, he was definitely, you know, he's obviously a fit lad now. And but he was always fast and he was always impressive, and not many guys like Tiger who've gone through swing changes the way he has. But I look at most tour players, best, you know, world-class players that I know, they are who they are. They swing their swing, you know, that old cliche. But I mean, you know, like I say, you can't change who you are. And you know, 21-22 years into my playing career, you know, I've tried to change who I am a little bit, but as I feel like in my 40s and, you know, the last couple of years, I'm starting to try and embrace a little bit more who I used to be and who I am, and just try to make that as good as it can be every day.
Now, talk to me a little bit about your swing. You're one of the things I like about you, which there are many. I can tell it's you from a distance. There's nobody else looks like you. Swing wise,
I feel like you could say that about so many players.
Well,
you know, I
think not so much these days.
Right, yeah,
you know, the modern way.
That's true.
You know,
that's fair. I mean, I think maybe talking about the guys that I've grown up playing with the last 20 years. Yeah, yeah, my generation of player, you can recognize Ian Poulter from 2 miles away, and Westwood, and you know, Garcia, and you know, it's, you know, there's no doubt idiosyncratic moves, like you say, the modern day golf swing. Wouldn't call it one-dimensional, but it's definitely a slightly different-looking technique. It's long and it's powerful, and it's certainly the young breed coming through, 185, 190 ball speed plus. I mean, it's definitely an era. It's going to be interesting. I'm excited to see where golf goes in the next 20 years. My previous 20 years, the game has evolved a huge amount, but I feel like we're coming into a new way of playing the sport where, you know, obviously driving the ball is premium. You know, the bit in the middle is obviously still pretty important, and you got to get in the hole. Yeah. But you know, obviously the power game is really something that's you know, taken over the sport a little bit.
People who are listening to this will be not surprised to hear me ask this question now. Is that necessarily a good thing at your level? I mean, there should be an advantage for if I can hit it 20 yards past you, but the advantage now seems to be so overwhelming that it's taken away from the rest of the game a little bit, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it just bothers me that the best courses in the world start to become a little, you know, when I think of St Andrews, I think of the road hole. You know, when they put that new tee by in there at the road hole, I was a bit like, where are we going here? Well, what's happening? Yeah. You know, it's like the integrity of the best golf courses in the world. Mm. You know, you're starting to, you know, but to me, St Andrews is not about length. It's about the wind and the weather, the pins. And, you know, you can, you know, it's one of my favorite golf courses on the planet, but I hate to see these new tees going in. You know, I hate playing open championship courses when you just know that the rooting of the golf course wasn't supposed to be like that. You weren't supposed to walk off
the
a green.
The strategy's getting lost.
You weren't supposed to walk off a green and have to hike 200 yards back to a new tee box, which is back halfway down the last hole you just played, you know.
I mean, funny you should mention that. I did that just for fun on a Sunday 2 or 3 years ago, just to see how far I would have to walk to go nowhere.
Yeah.
It was well over 2,000 yards.
2,000 yards back to tee boxes.
And back to where I was already.
Yeah. You know? And it really takes away from the flow, the way these golf courses were designed to be played in the beginning. But, you know, going back to the power game, you know, the ball rollback and all this stuff, you know, I mean, there's obviously a lot of reasons why the ball's going so far now. I mean, obviously it's coaching, it's technology, it's launch monitors, it's the understanding of how to propel the ball most efficiently. It's the way kids are getting coached nowadays. You know, it's not like when I was a kid, it was like, you know, get it in the fairway and, you know, we'll talk about maybe hitting it far after that. Now it's hit it as hard as you can and we'll figure out the straight part. And, you know, it's, you know, I've got a 6-year-old boy who likes playing golf and I'm telling them to hit it as hard as you can because you can learn the speed now at a young age. You can't pick the speed up in your 30s because I've tried and it's hard to do. Yeah. You learn that when you're young and like I say, the only thing that worries me is just the integrity of these great golf courses and having to build these new tee boxes and obviously modern architecture and 7,500, 8,000 yard golf courses, you know. So, I mean, aside from that, I mean, I think the power is, you know, that's it's a talent. It's you know, to watch these boys drive the ball the way they do. It's amazing, you know. And I think it's taken the sport into a new level of athleticism. And I think, you know, we need a little bit of that in our sport. You know, it is a skill game at the end of the day. But obviously, it's power and skill match now. It's definitely going to be interesting to see the evolution in the next 20 years.
It does bother me a little bit. And again, people on this listen to these podcasts will have heard me say this before, but the driving in my time of playing golf has gone from being the hardest thing to do, and sitting at your level is one of the easiest things. And the average driver on your tour is so much closer to the best driver now. I mean, Rory, I would argue, doesn't get the advantage that he should get from being the best driver.
Yeah.
And it used to be that Greg Norman, Nick Price, Ian Woosnam, they separated themselves by being great drivers.
Yeah.
It's hard to do that now.
For sure. I mean, I feel like I grew up in the era where the long guys were crooked. You know, back in the early 2000s when I first turned pro, long, talented drivers of the ball always could also be quite crooked off the tee. Yeah. To, you know, nowadays, the long guys are incredibly straight, you know, and that's obviously the technology and the forgiveness and the CGs and understanding the physics of exactly what makes a driver go straight and the coaching and launch monitors. And like I said, the efficiency of these ball flights and the fact that golf ball doesn't spin very much anymore, you know. So nowadays, the best drivers of the ball in the world, it is their best club in their bag, you know, when they lean on it heavily. You know, think about Rory at Firestone there 6-7 years ago when he won. I mean, he just blew. I mean, the way way he drove the ball was just obscene, you know. And I mean, when these guys that are phenomenal off the tee, when they have big driving weeks on certain golf courses, they can just absolutely, you know, they're three shots ahead of a guy like me before they start Augusta to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. You know, it was always a golf course for me where I felt like, you know, I'm two back every day standing on the first tee of Bubba and these guys that can drive it, you know, can dominate that golf course a bit.
I was actually going to bring that up. I was looking at your record.
Yeah, my Augusta record's not particularly stellar.
It's not much better than mine, Graham, to be honest. Is there a reason for that? I mean,
I think a little bit.
Just the distance?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a distance thing, and I think it's also a little bit of a... The golf course used to scare me a little bit, you know. Iron play, I would say, would be one of my strengths. Iron play and putting. And those are two things that I never did well at Augusta. And I feel like the iron play was down to standing in fairways and having a spot on the green that I felt like I had to pitch this iron in with the correct shape. And if I didn't hit that, I felt like I was going to make bogey or worse.
Yeah.
So I never played the course loose. I never played it free, you know, and I feel like Augusta's a horses for courses place because I feel like the best guys who play well there know where to miss it, you know, because golf is a game of misses.
Yeah.
And I felt like I went to Augusta and I never really let myself ever miss a shot. I'm not, you know, I felt so tight over every shot because I felt like I couldn't miss it. And that's obviously incorrect because, you know, there are slopes and hollows and chips that you can leave yourself and putts you can leave yourself that are absolutely fine. You can use the slopes. And I just never felt comfortable at Augusta.
I'm surprised to hear that. I mean, given where you grew up, I mean, one of the world's best golf courses, you played it every day, presumably. I mean, you should have been, at least on paper, more comfortable on places like that.
I know. It's weird. Augusta is my favorite course in the world. And, you know, for absolutely no reason, because it doesn't love me back. And like I said, it always was a golf course that stressed me out. You know, I never felt good out there. I never felt comfortable and I never putted well, you know, and again,
it's burning money there.
Absolutely. So it's like, you know, my strengths, my iron play and my putting were two strengths that I'm not going to say they became weaknesses, but they were negated when I went to Augusta because I just didn't feel comfortable about where I could miss the ball, you know. So obviously one of my regrets in my career was I didn't do better at Augusta. I mean, the other three majors, you know, I had runs in them, did okay in them. But Augusta, like I say, my favorite track on earth, and I'll go back there and drink a few beers hopefully one day and have a bit of crack and probably scratch my head and wonder why I didn't do better. But
Well, talk to me, we touched on it there, growing up at Portrush, I mean, must have been, did you appreciate it at the time? You kids never do, you know. I grew up in East Lothian, which is, you know, great courses everywhere. It was only when I came back as an adult, having been away, that I thought, oh, man, how lucky was I to grow up here?
Yeah, I think I appreciated it when I was young. You know, Portrush has the 36 holes plus a 9-hole par three. So, I mean, you know, 9, 10 years old, we were on the par three. And then we graduated onto the Valley course, which was a great little track. Yeah. Well, I think it only had 13 bunkers on the whole golf course, which was unusual. But, you know, the Dunluce, the championship course was the Augusta sort of for me when I was a kid, you know. And I remember sneaking out there summer evenings with my dad. You know, we weren't really sort of old enough or good enough to be allowed out there, but it was like literally – it was literally like Augusta, you know, the hallowed turf. And then, you know, eventually you played it so much where you took it a bit for granted. I was always proud of Portrush. I was always proud of where I grew up. And I was very lucky to have something like that on my doorstep. Facilities, cheap, affordable, approachable, you know, great juniors, or a really great junior section with a bunch of kids that, you know, we grew up playing with. And, you know, like I say, probably took the facilities a bit for granted eventually. And then, you know, fast forward to the 19 Open, going back there, obviously, you know, playing the Open Championship at Portrush since the first, you know, first time since 53 or whatever that date was. But
51.
Yeah. You know, and Max Faulkner and guy, you know, best players in the world coming up to me and saying, this is the best links course I've ever seen. And I'm like, really? Is it that good? I mean, I know it's good. Yeah, is it really the best you've ever seen? Yeah. So, I mean, that was sort of like a little bit of a, you know, eureka moment going, well, maybe, you know, maybe this is special. And it was obviously a special weekend, and watching Shane win, it was, you know, it was a pretty phenomenal Sunday afternoon. And like I say, you know, prior to where I grew up, and obviously very fortunate that the game of golf became available to me, and my dad took it up late in life and probably didn't have two pennies to rub together, but thankfully the game of golf was affordable and mm-hmm. he fell in love with it. And we sort of by osmosis fell in love with it as well. And certainly it's given me a lot, and, you know, certainly proud of what I've accomplished in the game. And like I say, you know, we said at the start, still love it a lot. It's a game that never gets old for me.
You were a bit of a prodigy though, weren't you? I mean, you were, you know, when did it become clear that there was some, you know, a bit of a special talent there?
Yeah, I'm not sure prodigy would have been sort of the word I'd have used. You know, I certainly, I feel like I was just behind the prodigies, you know, David Jones, who actually caddies for Lydia Ko now. He was probably the best young player in Ireland when I was, you know, him and I came up together. And then Ricky Elliott, who obviously caddies for Brooks now, he was a couple of years ahead of me and a guy I looked up to. And I was always very good at kind of like looking to the next level about what I wanted to achieve. You know, I remember seeing the Irish international waterproof jacket and golf bag and going, man, I'd love one of those one day, you know, and, you know, climbing the ranks and getting there. And then, you know, seeing the college golf bag with a logo on the side of it saying, you know, College Golf in America, that's what I want to do. And that was really the turning point for me, I guess, was college in the US.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you really kicked on there, didn't you?
I did.
Talk to me about where you were when you arrived and where you were when you left as a player.
Yeah, I think that was a big change in my life. I mean, I think, you know, I wasn't good enough. You know, I wasn't sort of the very, very high level standout guy that got recruited by the best schools in America. And I really don't think there was a lot of British and Irish recruitment at that point. It was really just starting to happen.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the money to go anywhere, and I wasn't recruited, and I didn't have the know-how to get there. Ricky and a few of my friends went to Toledo, and eventually Toledo didn't have any scholarship money, so I couldn't, you know, they couldn't afford to bring me there. And so I ended up, you know, just kind of continuing my education. I went to Queens in Belfast for a year, and I got the call halfway through the year from UAB. A guy called Chris Devlin, who was from Ballymena in Northern Ireland, ended up randomly in Birmingham, Alabama at UAB, gave the coach my number, called me, said, would you be interested in coming out and having a look? And I said, yeah, I'd be very interested. It's what I've always wanted to do. Yeah. It's what I've always wanted to do. I'd never been to the States before, and, you know, ended up in Birmingham, Alabama, which, you know, obviously is a pretty historic city, you know.
It's had a bit of an influence on your accent, to be fair.
It's definitely messed my accent up to, you know, much to the amusement of your listeners, I'd imagine. You know, I remember coming home after my first year, and I'd put on about 15 pounds, and I, you know, had this crazy, crazy accent, you know. So it wasn't like a conscious decision, but I remember thinking to myself about a few months into my first year in Alabama, thinking, I'm going to spend the rest of my life repeating myself, or something's going to have to just maybe change a smidge here, you know. And
I can sympathize. I lived over there for 8 years in the Northeast in Connecticut, which is not, the accent there's not as extreme as where we're talking, where you were. So that the fact that you changed is far more likely than it was for me. You know?
But then I'll meet people in the US that have lived there for 25 years and their accent's thick as it was.
Just off the boat.
Just like they're literally just off the boat. And I'm thinking to myself, what part of my brain made me take on this kind of, you know, mid-Atlantic kind of, you know, like I say, humorous, people think it's hilarious. And, you know, it's not something I really tried
it's certainly
to do.
Distinctive.
So, you know, hopefully maybe next chapter of my life, maybe, you know, if I go into the media ranks, you know, it might make me a few quid or not, you know, so we'll see. But, you know, like I said, going back to that, that was a really a big changing, a huge turning point in my life, because if I'd ended up in Toledo, would I be sitting here today? Because all my mates went to Toledo and they never really kicked on. I'm not sure if it was weather or facilities or coaching or whatever. They never really kicked on. And for some reason, I just lucked out where I ended up. Birmingham had amazing golf courses, amazing facilities. The golf coach wasn't really a coach, so he left our swings alone. So we just played a lot of golf. I remember standing in a bunker. It was end of January, middle of my first year. I was in shorts. The sun was shining. I was practicing. I've thought to myself, I'm for the first time got a competitive advantage on the guys back in the UK and Ireland that I'm trying to beat. Yeah. I remember just having this kind of weird epiphany, you know, going, I'm one up here. Mm-hmm. And I went home that summer and I won everything. Gone from being an international player for Ireland, but not one of the best, to having a standout summer where I pretty much won everything I teed it up in, got in the Walker Cup team, which was special, and that kicked me on. That elevated me to the next level, and you know, played well my final 2 years in college. I think I won 3 times my second year, and I won 6 times my last year. I only had 3 years of eligibility.
Yeah, you were becoming almost dominant.
I was number one ranked player in Division One golf, and you know, it was like, okay, what do we do now? We turn pro, and I came back to Europe, obviously, because I had a higher profile back here. I could get some starts, the Irish Open, the European Open, and the K Club. Slaley Hall was actually my debut, Great North Open, and Chubby was managing me in those days. It's interesting, the little decisions that kind of shape your life. You know, spending time around Clark and Westwood, and these guys were international superstars who, you know, didn't just jump on planes to go to Japan to play golf tournaments. They jumped on planes to go to Japan to win golf tournaments, you know, and they were winners. Yeah. And that was a good early influence for me in my career, was, you know, that you don't just show up, you win tournaments.
Yeah.
That's what you do. And so that helped me a lot in the beginning, you know, fly business class, stay in nice hotels, eat steak.
What's that like?
And play good. And play good. You know, it was kind of like invest in yourself. Act like you're Lee Westwood, and you know, before you even become that good, you know. So yeah, little things like that were important for me back in my young days, and you know, I was lucky enough that I won early. Took all the
fourth tournament.
Yeah. Took all the kind of clawing, sort of for air.
The whole world opens up when you
for sure. Yeah. And I mean, you know, golf's an amazing sport, and you know, we could talk for hours about, you know, why players make it, why certain players don't make it. You know, qualifying school, it's a lottery.
Yeah.
How many great players are out there? How many great players never had a chance to play in a major championship that could have won, that are more talented than the guys that are out there doing it week in, week out? I always think it's harder to get out there than it is to stay out there. Once you're out there, if you're any good and you have any discipline, you know, you can make a great career out of it. But it's hard to get out there.
Yeah.
And like I say, I was fortunate enough to come off a winning mentality in college. I remember I missed the cut at Slaley. I think I finished 35th at the Irish Open. Can't remember what I did at the K Club. Missed the qualifying for the Open Championship, and Chubby sent me to the Challenge Tour in Germany. And I remember sort of saying, I don't want to go to the Challenge Tour.
What was that like?
Yeah. I remember it was a washed out event in Germany that Ian Pyman won. And I think I finished second to him.
Right.
But, like, you know, Chubby sent me out there kicking and screaming a little bit because I want to play in the, you know, but I didn't have any starts coming. It was a, you know, again, little small, you know, I went out there, finished second in a pro event, going, okay, I remember how to do this again.
It sometimes helps to see what you don't want.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's no doubt. I think sometimes, like you say, a little sniff of the Challenge Tour, okay, I don't want to be here.
Exactly.
It's also that little bit of a confidence boost where you kind of feel like you're good enough to compete.
Yeah.
You're good enough to win. You know, it's like, you know, we'll talk about sort of the LIV Tour, I'm sure, as we go on here, but like, it's nice to come to an event like here at Close House where I feel like, you know, if I play well, I can win.
Yeah.
I've always, scheduling has always been important in my career in that, you know, you need to bounce up and down levels, because if you spend too much time at the top, you'll get chewed up if you're not playing well.
Yeah.
So it's nice to kind of drop down maybe a level or two, feel kind of good about yourself, compete, get the kind of juices flowing a little bit, and then take yourself back up again, you know? So it's really kind of sharpening and kind of, because, you know, like we talked about, there's so much mental, you know, the mental element of the sport's huge, and confidence and belief and all these things. And you can't just pluck those out of the sky.
What you're talking about. Yeah.
I mean, you just can't pluck this stuff out of the sky.
Fine margins.
Yeah. No doubt. And you can't find it in the range. You know, some psychologists can't talk it into you. Mm-hmm. You have to be out there, and you have to feel it, and you have to know it inside that you're good enough to compete. It comes and goes. It's crazy.
That's golf, isn't it?
Yeah.
You mentioned the Walker Cup there. I didn't want to bypass that. What are your memories of 2001 at Sea Island? Because that was quite a team, and you won, of course.
Yeah, Peter McAvoy was the captain. Mm-hmm. I remember him.
How did you get on with him? He's been a guest on this podcast.
Yeah. I got on great with him, I think, from memory. I mean,
not everybody did. So yeah. I'm sure he would be the first to tell you.
You know, it's funny. He did a really cool thing, and we actually used it in Paris at the last Ryder Cup when Harrington was captain. And it was a really cool thing because he got the team together the night or couple nights before the tournament start, and he kind of made – he made a big deal of presenting us all with the team sweater. It didn't matter what it was. It was a sweater. But, you know, he called every player up individually and, you know, "Luke Donald, you've done this, 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 and this. You're, you know, you are a champion, and that's why you're on this team. Graham McDowell, this is what you have." You know, he made everyone feel very special. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really cool little piece of psychology because, you know, so we're in Paris and it's Harrington's Ryder Cup. And of course, you got Rory McIlroy in the room. And you've got Bernd Wiesberger in the room. No disrespect.
John Rahm.
You've got rookies. And you've got the best, absolute top of the tree guy, right? So the rookie's always going to feel inferior in that room. So I suggested it to Harrington that because I thought it was just one of those things that stuck with me, you know, and I think it's just so important to kind of make a big deal about everyone and make them feel like they deserve to be in that room. So that was one of my memories from the Walker Cup in 01. We had a great team. It was hotter than hell. I'd never played in that type of heat before. Obviously, they were in Memphis at the FedEx last week, which kind of reminded me of what Sea Island was like in August. I'd never, you know, coming from Ireland, and obviously I'd played some college golf, but I'd never played in American summer heat before. It was 115, crazy hot.
Because you'd be back here in the summer.
Yeah, exactly. I'd always play my college golf. Yeah. I'd come home in June, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't go back out till sort of mid-August. So Michael Hoey and I played foursomes together. We won both our foursomes. And I played Bryce Mulder twice in the singles, and Bryce Mulder was best amateur in the world at the time. And he beat me on 17 and he beat me on 18 on Sunday. So, you know, lost both my singles, which was disappointing, but it was a great time. I just remember great team of lads, Stephen O'Hara, Mark Warren, Nick Doherty, Luke Donald. It was great. You know, it was special to, you know, the Walker Cup. Yeah, team stuff special. You know, they're my best memories. I don't have a lot of, like, I'm not a memorabilia guy. I don't keep a lot of things, you know. Obviously, you know, nice to have my trophies and whatever. And I have my golf bags. I have my Walker Cup bag and I have my Ryder Cup bags. And those are sort of my special, you know, those are special things to me because they're good memories.
Have you got a room for all that stuff? Or
Are they
in the garage?
Yeah, they're in the garage. Well, it's a garage, like inverted commas. Right. It's sort of like, you know, decked out. You know, I've got my clubs and I got, you know, just my storage areas and stuff. Right. And I've got these little cubbies for my golf bag, sort of like little presentation cases, if you like, you know, my Walker Cup bag and my four Ryder Cup bags and a couple of Ice Captain bags. The Ryder Cup, they sit down down below a bit. Yeah. But no, I mean, like I say, the team experience that I've had in my career far outshine any individual experiences I've ever had. You know, I mean, the Ryder Cup is something super special.
We're talking about somebody here who won the US Open at Pebble Beach. Are you telling me that that's below what you just talked about?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think emotionally.
Really?
Emotionally, there's nothing quite like team events and the Ryder Cup. I mean, yeah, it's the greatest moments of my career. You know, I mean, I think I look at all four. Obviously, it's easy to focus in on Celtic Manor in 10 because I played the last match. But, yeah, there was something incredibly unenjoyable about that because, you know, you're shitting yourself, you know. And it's just very hard to kind of, you know, when people think, oh, that must have been amazing. No, it was really hard. It was a very difficult, nerve-wracking moment in my life. But, of course, afterwards, you know, it's amazing. And you look back and you go, that was something special. In the moment, it's not enjoyable. You know, the four Ryder Cups, 2008, we got beaten Valhalla, but it was my rookie year. And I felt like I won my singles and I won a match with Pults, which was probably the best Ryder Cup match I've played maybe ever. We beat Furyk and Kenny Perry on Saturday afternoon. And it was a great game. You know, so 8 was special, even though we lost. 10 was special for the obvious reasons. 12, Medina. It was a bittersweet one. I mean, it was an amazing weekend, miracle at Medina. I lost my singles on Sunday, which
remember,
is,
you weren't playing great. There's always somebody arrives not playing great. Yeah. Right? There's not what you can do about that, is there?
Yeah, it was a funny weekend for me. I was only supposed to play Friday morning. They told me I was being sat down Friday afternoon. So Rory and I win our match on Friday morning against Snedeker and Furyk. Got it up and down in the bunker at the last. Rory hit a great trap shot about 6 feet. I made it to win. And I remember having this like huge relief thinking, you know, and then McGinley was the vice captain. He told me I was going straight back out in the afternoon. And I was like, I remember coming out that afternoon so
ready for
so flat.
Yeah.
It was like mentally I'd nearly prepped that I wasn't playing, and then I just remember being incredibly tired that weekend. I think I'd played a lot of golf and I just couldn't muster up the energy to get myself playing good enough that afternoon, and sort of coupled with the fact that playing better ball with Rory, and Rory's hitting at 350 down the middle. And I remember going into one of these par fours about the seventh and hit 8-iron in the morning off Rory's drive, and I'm going in with 4-iron in the afternoon thinking, geez, is this course a bit longer than I thought it was? Yeah. You know, and I played badly that afternoon, and it kind of knocked the stuffing out of me for the rest of the weekend. Rory and I got beat again in the morning in the foursomes by Snedeker and Furyk on the last again. Didn't play Saturday afternoon. And then Zach Johnson beat me on 17 on Sunday. But, I mean, it was miracle in the diner.
Don't be cared at that point.
I got to do the opposite of Celtic Manor. I got to, you know, Celtic Manor, you're the guy on stage, everyone's watching. I got to kind of be like, okay, I lost my singles. Let's go support the boys. And, you know, I got to be able to, you know, watch my team and Martin Kaymer get the job done, you know. And then 14 Glen Eagles was probably my favorite of all the Ryder Cups I've played.
Because, well, you had a specific role there. Paul had you playing with Victor Wisong months before.
Yeah, it was cool. It was nice to sort of be mature enough and be experienced enough to be able to kind of think about somebody else for a change. Taking Victor under my wing a little bit.
He's a very different character, isn't he?
Very different. And you know, Paul actually handled him extremely well that week, you know, because he's a guy who likes his space and he likes his mates around him and doesn't really like to kind of have to be here at a certain... He's a bit of an enigma. He likes to do his own thing. And Paul handled him incredibly well. Victor and I had a good relationship. He played stunningly well in the two foursomes games that I played with him. And like I say, I felt like I was able to kind of nearly focus on somebody else for the weekend. And it gave me like this sort of opportunity to be able to take it all in a little bit, which was amazing. And, you know, we won both our foursomes. And then I led Europe off on Sunday and beat Spieth. And, you know, obviously it was a pretty rampant victory that weekend. And that was, in a funny way, nearly my favorite of the four Ryder Cups. Mm. You know, it was obviously my last. But like I say, they've all been very special for different reasons for me. And, you know, they overshadow a US Open just because they're just more emotional. You know, you share experiences with guys, you create bonds, it's just something a bit different. A major winning tournaments is very individual. It's me, my coach, my caddy, my family, the people close to me. That's it, you know. If I don't win, that's it. I'm letting them down, and that's the end. If you know, the Ryder Cup is just something different, right? I mean, you're representing your continent, you're representing everything, you know, that is the European Tour, that is your friends, your colleagues, your heroes, your peers, everything, you know. It's a bit special.
Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda means less work and more play. Tough by name and by nature, this turf variety, supplied exclusively by Lawn Solutions Australia, is the perfect choice for your home lawn. With superior drought tolerance, speedy recovery and toughness, Tiff Tough really is the smart grass. For more information and to find your nearest accredited supplier, head to lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au.
You mentioned 08 there. I've always been quite impressed by the fact that you and your fellow teammates have never really thrown your captain under the bus after that week. Because it was a pretty controversial week.
Who was the captain there?
It was Mr. Faldo, yes. I've always been impressed by that. I'm not expecting you to do any different here, but that must have been a bit different. But you wouldn't know it was a bit different at that point, given it was your first one. But the European camaraderie thing, it maybe gets a wee bit overblown, but it's definitely a big part of it, isn't it?
No doubt. I mean, I think, you know, every captain's different, you know, and I think it, you know, Faldo, 08, Faldo was my hero in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, he was the guy I looked at, and, you know, he was, you know, had a few Pringle sweaters in the closet. He was the man, you know, and it was obviously pretty special to play my first Ryder Cup under him. He's certainly an interesting guy, as I've gotten to know him over the years. And, you know, what makes a great Ryder Cup captain? I think that really,
a bit of luck.
For sure. It's like, what makes a great coach or a great caddy? Well, a great player.
Yeah.
What makes a great Ryder Cup captain? A great team, right? But, you know, obviously, it's like I look at Harrington in 21 Whistling Straits, yeah, the last Ryder Cup. I mean, he did everything right and takes the historic beating. Does that mean he's a bad captain? No. I mean, I was his vice captain. He was not a bad, he was a good captain. Yeah. He did a lot of great things. Right. So winning captains, are they heroes? Or is the team just good, right? Yeah. I mean, Faldo.
I
mean,
I look back at that last one, and I've said this before, that I think on here, it's such a fine line. I mean, if you, on the Saturday night, you're 6 points behind. Rory has played poorly for him and has lost three matches. Rory plays well and wins three, you're tied.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's that, you know, the importance of the top players. I mean, the formula for winning is not difficult to figure out. If your top three players all play well and win 3.5, 4 points out of five, you'll win.
Correct.
It's that simple.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's a lot of emphasis put on the captains, you know, obviously Watson and Gleneagles. I mean, you know, Faldo in 08. Like, to me, there's no point throwing the captains under the bus because they have such a small impact on what they can actually do for the weekend. Mm-hmm. They create the environment.
Yeah.
They, you know, in Europe, they obviously help set the course up to a certain extent. They create the chemistry and the partnerships. But like at that point, like you say, it's down to the guys. They got to play good. They got to pull putts. Yeah. They got to perform.
Well, you can do everything right. And, you know, you're playing me and I go out and I hold one more putt more than you. Yeah. I'm going to win. You know,
like I say, I mean, Harrington was probably, that was probably the most involved that I'd been. Who was the vice captain? Thomas, in Paris. Mm-hmm. You know, just Paris was a perfect golf course. Yeah. You know, it's just, you know, I'd imagine Rome is going to be a little similar, perhaps. You know, Paris was just a golf course that we do so well.
Yeah.
You know, played so many French Opens around there. I mean, it's a really unique golf course. And I mean, I don't think the Americans were ready for that track, you know.
I had to laugh, and I've said this before, I keep saying that, but I glanced up at the top of the hill, and there was Jim Furyk, Matt Kuchar, Zach Johnson, and somebody else. And I remember thinking, they should all be playing on this golf course.
No, I remember,
far better than some of the guys who were playing.
I remember standing on a tee with Kuchar thinking to myself, we'd probably do okay around this track here. You know, it'd be a decent game with us here. So, you know, I look at, you know, like I say, I was probably more involved in Harrington's team a little bit just because I became more immersed in just the way he did things. And like I say, he did a great job and took an absolute beat down. So does that mean he's a bad guy? Does that mean it's tainted his legacy? You know, is he not a great champion? Is he not, you know, no. Okay. Yes, he is. I mean, he's absolutely, you know, one of the, you know, European Tour, you know, one of Ireland's greatest players, three-time major champion, great Ryder Cup captain.
Yeah.
He lost, but, you know, so I think there's a lot of emphasis put on these captains. And was Faldo bad? No, he's different. I mean, you know, I didn't know any different, so it didn't really bother me too much. I had a great weekend. And
I must admit, Graham, I have to say, I was, when he was making his speech at the opening ceremony, I was back in my hotel watching it on television, and I was lying on the bed, and I actually had to get up off the bed. I was becoming physically uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Just, and I actually shouted at the television, make him stop. He threw a couple
of Irish jokes in there. You know, yeah. Paddy got the potatoes in Ireland and all that stuff, and I got the, what part of Ireland am I from? That's not a big deal at all, which part of Ireland you're from, right? Yeah. I mean, there's been no violence, no bloodshed over that one at all, has there? I mean, it was a little uncomfortable at times, but you know, that's Faldo's own kind of flavor of wit a little bit as well, you know. Yeah. And he's made millions from it, so who are we to argue?
Fair enough. Before we get to Pebble Beach, I did want to ask you about the team aspect of LIV Golf. I mean, I'm with you. I think that given the way that we don't know what's going to happen, the way the jigsaw puzzle of world golf is at the moment, but I think, ironically, I think the team golf might be the thing that survives. I mean, how do you feel about that? Maybe like the IPL cricket, there'll be a month set aside for team golf. Who knows? I don't know.
But I mean, you know, the first season last year when we played the sort of beta season, if you like, the eight events, I mean, that was the part that kind of blew me away the most, was how compelling the team stuff was and how much guys were into it. I'm like, well, we're going to play for 20 million individually each week. Who's going to care about the 5 million team money, you know, and that's going to fade into insignificance.
Yeah.
But it was quite the opposite. And it's the part I probably enjoy the most on LIV is it sort of breaks the monotony of, you know, the 25, 30 weeks on tour, just dragging it out by yourself. You know, there's something nice about practicing with a team, info sharing, pulling for each other, working for something bigger than just yourself, you know, and that's why I think that the, you know, listen, Liv's got a long way to go from the franchise's point of view before people around the world recognize the Rippers and, you know, what is a clique, you know, and, you know, the Majestics. And there's a long way to go there before that's a real thing. But I really do feel like the ingredients are there. I think the players believe in it, which is the most important thing that I think, because the fan knows when they switch the TV on whether a guy's into it or not. You know, you can't fake it, right? And we're certainly not out there playing exhibition golf. I hate when I read that, you know, it's this exhibition match. It's, you know, it's not. Guys are working really hard. There's a lot of money on the line. There's a lot of stuff to play for. Mm-hmm. And these guys are competitive and they care, right?
I don't question that for a second, but the hardest thing, if I'm typical, I mean, I'm Mr. Golf fan at the moment. The hardest hurdle, the biggest hurdle that you guys have got is getting me to care about who wins.
Yeah, for sure. No doubt. And I think the FedEx Cup has the same problem. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of
I don't care about that either.
No. And there's no doubt about that. I totally agree with you. The four majors will always be the four majors, and they will be the most special golf tournaments on planet Earth, and the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup. They're the most special tournaments on planet Earth, right? Everything else has to fight for oxygen below that. And you've got to create platforms that are compelling for the fan. And I do think the team thing, there's something there.
Definitely, because it's so divorced from the majors.
Yeah.
If anybody coming into golf, like Live Golf have done, I mean, if they're smart, they won't even consider getting in the way of the majors. Mm-hmm. Just let them be.
Know? No, and they should be, right? And then it goes back to the whole 72-54 debate, right? I mean, I just think that golf doesn't always have to be 72 holes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always have to be stroke play. Yeah. It doesn't have to be traditional, you know.
I don't want the same of anything every week.
No, I think the fan wants something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But it has to be real. Like you said, you have to care. All right. And I mean, that's why the franchise thing's interesting. If there's a team representing every country in the world, you know, the Australians, the Koreans, the Japanese, the English, the Irish, the Americans, the South America, all of a sudden you start to kind of get that little partisan.
That would be a smart way to break it down to start with.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I think they'd love to get there, but obviously, you know, there's a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of countries that, you know, that need to be represented. There's a lot of countries that don't want to be involved. And, you know, we all know the negativity and the hurdles that exist at the minute, but there is something there. How does it plug into the big puzzle of the world of golf, right? So you got the majors, you got the PGA Tour, you got the European Tour, the Asian Tour, the LIV Tour. You've got all these little puzzle pieces that need to fit in. End of the day, it really comes down to what John Rahm and Brooks Koepka and Rory McIlroy and Bryson DeChambeau and Dustin Johnson. It really comes down to what they want to do, what they want to play in, how many events is too much. You got the four majors. How many live events does Rory McIlroy want to play? If we got to that point, right?
Doesn't sound like many at the moment, to be
honest. And I mean, you know, how many PGA Tour events does Brooke Koepka want to play? Maybe not very many, right? So it's like there's a lot of stuff. There's, you know, there's questions that need answered. Yeah. Will this merger even happen? You know,
who knows?
At least we've laid down our weapons, the game of golf. You know, we can be friends and we can all operate inside of the same ecosystem. Maybe there's not going to be some sort of overlapping schedule. There's not going to be guys jumping back and forth. Maybe they just continue down their paths.
Hopefully they're all talking about that right now.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the powers that be will figure that out. You know, they'll come up with something potentially tangible and they got to go sit down with the best players in the world and say, can you do this? And if they can, brilliant. You know, I think the golf fan will win because, you know, if you get, you know, the best players in the world playing against each other more often and something they give a shit about, then you're off to the races.
Well, I've talked about this before and I've written about this as well, that the getting the best players in the world playing against each other more often is fine up to a point. Mm-hmm. But again, you get into the sameness thing.
Yeah, I don't. For sure.
I would like to think that the top guys will split up to a certain extent three or four times a year, and they'll all go off and play somewhere that's going to make a difference. My mind always goes back to Rory McIlroy played in the South African Open 3 or 4 years ago as a favour to Ernie. The place was moving with people because he was there. I think they're so important, these guys, and I think I would argue that they could do more.
Yeah.
They could go once a year. If everybody went once a year, top 10 in the world went somewhere once a year for nothing, just because it was the right thing to do, it would all be better.
There's no doubt. I agree with what you're saying there completely. You know, we're all about this F1 model, right? You know, where you know who's showing up every week. That's cool because the sponsor knows what he's getting.
Every week.
I know. There's a sameishness to
this,
right?
This word same, I want you to get away from that.
And I alluded to it at the start of our conversation. You know, I'm very happy where I'm playing. I think Liv's a fun product. I like the team stuff. I like our schedule. I like playing a bit less, but I also don't like the sameishness of it. You know, it's a very high standard because you're playing against Brooks Koepka, Cam Smith, Dustin Johnson, Bryson every week. And if you don't get going in the 54 hole format, it's a sprint. If you don't get off to a start, you know, you're finishing 30th and it doesn't feel good. You know, so there's something, you know, I need to supplement my schedule with some golf. That's why I'm here, you know, at Close House this week. I need other golf to be able to maybe drop down a little. I don't want to, you know, we are dropping down a level from, you know, we're, you know, if it was a world ranking points versus world ranking points, this is a level below, you know, Liv. Coming here knowing that if I play good golf, that I have a chance to win a tournament. Right. So, and I need that. And I've always needed that in my career. And I've always needed that for my general mental state because, you know, if I'm finishing 25th, 30th every week and Live, that's not making me feel good about myself. And I need to feel good. Otherwise, you know, it becomes a very difficult game. The physical side, I can do it. It's the mental side that I can't do if I don't believe in myself and I don't have confidence. Yeah. So I'm excited to come here this week. I've actually got 3 or 4 more Asian Tour events that I'll play between now and the end of the year. I'd love an opportunity.
Are you playing next week in Scotland?
I'm not actually. I would have played. My little brother's going to be in Florida with his kids, and I wanted to get back and see him for 4 or 5 days before he flies back to Ireland. So otherwise, I would have went up there. It would have been fun. I'm off the back of 2, so that would be 4 in a row. Mm. I try not to get away from the kids for more than 3 max if I can. So, but yeah, I'll play Singapore and Hong Kong and Indonesia at the end of the year. I mean, listen, I need to supplement my schedule with something.
Yeah.
If it's not the PGA Tour and it's not the DP World Tour, it's going to be the Asian Tour. So 14's not enough for me. 30's too many and 14's not enough. It's about 22 is probably my number, you know, and I'm getting a bit older. I just turned 44. But, you know, like we said, I still love it. I still love competing. I still have some things I want to do. I want to win a live event. I'd like to get back in the majors, play a few more major championships. There's things I want to achieve in the sport.
Yep. You played 54 so far.
54 majors?
Yep.
Jeez.
Only 5 top tens.
Yeah, not very good.
Yeah.
Anyway, not very good.
I was going to ask you, on the subject of live before we get to Pebble Beach, which we will do, run me through your decision-making process at the beginning of that.
You know, May, June last year, getting ready for the, I mean.
Whether to do it or not.
Yeah, I mean, should I stay or should I go?
Yeah.
I made a lot of phone calls, spoke to people in the game that I trusted, spoke to my sponsors, spoke to my family, of course. You know, weighed the risk-reward elements. Being honest, the financial reward was just about enough to kind of move the needle for me.
And your time of life as well.
In my time of life, I'm not going to tell you they paid me $100 million because they didn't. No. You know, they paid me enough to make the decision worthwhile in the space that I was in the sport. I'd tasted the top 20 in the world and the top 10 in the world, and I'd been paid as a top 10, top 20 player in the world for 4 or 5 years. But I was coming down the other side of that crest.
Well, you're at that age. I mean, there's no shame to mid 40s. Yeah. It's when typically there's a dip.
You know, I was dipping, and you know, in a funny way, the pandemic knocked the life out of me. You know, I went into the pandemic just off the back of winning the Saudi International, ironically. You know, when it was a European tour, co-sanctioned with Asian Tour, won that, just shot 68 in the first round of the players, coming off the back of a top 5 in Hawaii. So, I mean, I was starting to get a wee head of steam up again, you know, and I was excited. And then the world shut down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what happened to me. I spent the 3 months training. I was biking and I was in a decent shape and came back out to play all fired up, and something clicked in my head. I just wasn't sure if it was just no fans or just this new world.
It was certainly different.
There was an eeriness to what we were doing.
Having said that, from a journalist's point of view, Graham, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
We got access to players like you'd never believe.
That's
before.
Crazy. Yeah. But it knocked the absolute stuffing out of me, and I proceeded to have the worst 18 months of my career.
Yeah.
Missed so many cuts and went down the rabbit hole again, got a new coach and tried to reinvent myself. And that I hurt myself. I had multiple tears in my forearm. Just weird stuff happened to me, you know. And then, you know, so that's end of 20 into 21. 22 was turning out to be a grind again, you know. And then here comes Liv, you know. And obviously through my relationship with winning the Saudi International, you know, I'd sparked up a relationship with Saudi Golf, Golf Saudi. And, you know, I liked the guys. I felt like they were into the game. I felt like, obviously, we spent a lot of time in the Middle East in our days, the last 20 years in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Qatar. And it was another Middle East golf opportunity, a lot of money.
Yeah. It seems to me, though, the whole business, the decision-making process for everybody involved in this was, you have to separate business from moral, the moral aspect of the argument. And businesses, the world over, seem to manage quite nicely to be able to do that. And in golf, the only bad thing I feel, why golf was getting singled out quite as much as, you know, you were just basically following the same path as everybody else. There's a lot of sports involved in Saudi Arabia. Certainly every multinational business.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to the first the tournament in Saudi 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. And the place I was staying was strange, but I could walk to the Burger King and, you know, mm-hmm. all these people, they were all there.
Yeah.
You know, so why, I mean, the moral aspect of it is, you know, nobody's going to win that argument.
For sure.
But everybody's there. So why golf got singled out?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you'd know the answer to that question better than I would. Was it a strategic planted narrative paid for by the PGA Tour? I don't know. I mean, I'm totally speculating when I say that. But, you know, you and I spoke about this when we were walking in here, you know, going back to Centurion and the first press conference. And I was not a paid ambassador for Saudi Arabia human rights. Mm-hmm. I was a paid ambassador for a golf tour.
Yeah. And well, that was your mistake.
When correct.
You talking.
And correct. Like, and
we're talking about that. I mean, that was the advice I
used. For sure.
What did I do wrong? I said, well, you got to a point where you didn't really know what you were talking about.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you start answering questions that don't even need, they can't be answered. No,
that's right.
You know, so, and that was obviously, I regret those answers. Not that they were necessarily wrong. That's what we'd been prepped to say by this golf tour that's paying me. I'm not being paid by the Saudi Arabian, you know, like I say, like this human rights organization. I'm being paid by this new startup golf tour, which is a financially lucrative opportunity for me at this stage of my career. The end. I mean, you know, you know, people said, well, if he'd have just said it was about the money. Well, of course it was about the money. Everybody of course knows. It was, right? So, you
we
know.
We all know that.
You know, we absolutely. I mean, that was like the great, you didn't need said. Of course that's what I was there for. Yeah. Right? I was a business.
And it
decision.
Made perfect sense. Again, your time of life. And Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter, again, perfect. I mean, of course they're going to do it at that time. They're not going to be winning consistently at the top level anymore. They're at that age where it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, you know, certainly feel like my skin's thickened up a lot the last 16 months. And I didn't handle it very well the summer, the first 3-4 months. You know, it bothered me. It bothered me that a reputation that I'd spent 20 years building had actually just burned overnight, you know. And I'm like, well, is it really that fickle? Is it really that? Is that, yeah, yes, it is the answer, right? Public opinion will absolutely turn on you in a second, right? So why do I care about that so much if it's that fickle? You know, because I know that I've been a good pro all my career, and I make a decision to go to a startup golf tour, and now I'm a bad guy. I know that I behave like a pro and I act like a pro, and I always have, you know. So what someone tells me on Twitter that they think of me, you know, I got to choose how I'm going to react to that, you know. And like I say in the beginning, when I first went to Live, I didn't handle it very well because I'd never really been criticized much in my career. And I'd never, like I said, I ever try to do is be a good pro. And obviously, you know, we talked about that press conference. I mean, it was an absolute minefield of disaster questions,
well,
you know.
A tabloid journalist went after you.
Yeah, for sure.
And it was, you were an easy target.
Yeah, for sure. And like I say, I talk too much, and that's the problem. And like I said, it wasn't like I said anything necessarily incorrect. I was trying to be an ambassador for a new tour. I wasn't trying to change the world.
You went down a track that you just...
For sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, like I say, totally regret it. But, you know, I've never been the Dustin Johnson. I've never been the I don't care man, yeah. You know. Yeah. That's not who I am. You know, I try to do my best. I try to articulate what I feel best I can. Sometimes, you know, you say too much. You know, it's like...
Well, you're far from alone. I mean, I see and hear Lee Westwood, being the one we talk about here, that gets so much grief for over going to live. And the European Tour, I mean, his relationship with them has deteriorated hugely. But I've got some sympathy for him more than some others, because at the level Lee was at, which was right at the top, he supported the European Tour more than anybody else did at that level. I mean, Ian Poulter, Justin Rose, Sergio.
Myself.
Didn't play nearly as often as he did.
For sure.
So I've got a wee bit more sympathy for him.
Totally agree. And I mean, it's probably the reason why I haven't got involved with the DP World Politics as much, because I just don't feel like I deserve a voice as much.
Well, you're not going to win that argument either.
Lee Westwood deserves a voice. He is a stalwart, absolute European Tour legend that has stood by them through thick and thin. And, you know, he's been treated the same way as the rest of us. And I don't think deservingly so, because, you know, like I said, I headed off to greener pastures. I've chased the dollar. I went, you know, well, you know, my wife's American. I live in America. Yeah. I've got kids in America. So, I mean, you know, that was my life. But I went to America because it was a financially lucrative opportunity for me, you know, like going to live. Yeah. It was about the money, and I was chasing greener pastures and better opportunities, you know. So, you know, I turned my back on the DP World Tour. You know, I came back and I cherry picked, you know, like all the things that they don't want us to do now. Yeah, we don't want these guys coming back cherry picking the best events. Well, that's what they've always done. It's what John Rahm does. It's what Rory McIlroy does. We've always done it. We played America.
Yeah.
And when there's, you know, the European Tour will piece the schedule around so that there's opportunities for the best players in the world to come back and cherry pick, play for a lot of money and get paid. That's how golf's always been, and it continues. Yeah, listen, I'm disappointed, you know, that we are, you know, I'd love an opportunity to support PGA Tour events that I love. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really have any exemptions left in America. I have some exemptions left in Europe. I'd love to come back and support the European Tour events. I'd love to come back and support the Irish Open and the Scottish Open and the events that I love. You know, so I'm hopeful that opportunity may arise someday. People will be listening and they'll say, well, you walked away from that. You don't deserve it. No, I understand I walked away from that. You know, I didn't want the game to be fractured the way it was. And I knew that was a risk going back to the decision-making process. I knew what I was walking away from.
Yeah, but if the European Tour is smart and looking at it purely in a business sense again, they'll want you guys to come back because you're a draw. I mean, I'd come and watch you guys far more than some young guys that I've never heard of. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, listen, you tell me that if Lee Westwood shows up at the Senior British Open a few weeks ago, he doesn't draw, you know, 10 or 20,000 people come watch him.
Yeah.
You know, if he goes to Wentworth, you tell me that Lee Westwood doesn't draw a crowd to Wentworth? Mm. It's kind of cutting your nose off to spite your face. You know, I get it, though. You know, DP World Tour have to, they've got their strategic alliance with the PGA Tour. They feel like that's the best path for them. They had their opportunity with Saudi Arabia and kind of, you know, what they wanted to do for the European Tour. You know, at the end of the day, the European Tour brought these guys to the table. You know, they made their bed with the PGA Tour, and listen, I hope the tour thrives, because all I care about are the players out there. They are my friends. Mm. I want them to thrive. I want them to have great events to play in. Would I like to have an opportunity to play sometime down there? Of course I would. Love to support the sponsors, support the tour that kind of made me who I am. You know, I think, you know, yes, Poulter, Garcia, Rose, myself, all those guys that kind of, you know, chased the dollar and went to America. I think if you ask them where their heart lies, I think their heart probably still lies on the European Tour. You know, we care more deeply about that because it's our roots and it's our heroes, and it's the, you know, our heroes built that tour, and the PGA Tour to a certain extent is a little bit more soulless for us because we're not Americans, you know? So, you know, there's no doubt there's a lot of guys that still love, you know, and care deeply about, you know, the European Tour and the direction that it's going.
Enough of this. Pebble Beach, win the US Open. I mean, if you're going to win the US Open, that's the place to win it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you must look back on that. I was still amazed by what you said earlier, that, you know, the Ryder Cup, I mean, it's to their own, but if I'd won the US Open at Pebble Beach, I'd be telling everybody there's nothing better than that. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it was a good time. No doubt it was a good time. I mean, you know, it was a surreal week. You know, I won the Welsh Open 2 weeks previous at Celtic Manor. Played probably some of the best golf I've ever played that weekend at Celtic Manor. I was like,
well, before you go any further, I do feel I'm always been a little bit miffed that, you know, my contribution to your winning at the US Open hasn't really been recognised here, Graham. I mean,
I have to explain that one.
You and I played together in the Pro-Am at Wentworth 3 weeks before when the new Wentworth appeared. And, you know, obviously seeing my game up close would give you a real boost, I'm sure.
Was that the first redo of Wentworth?
Yeah, how bad it was.
I remember
you
that.
You got yourself into trouble.
I got myself in, because I played with yourself and a couple of other media guys, and I did a hole-by-hole of the changes, which Mr. Ellis took particular offense to for some reason, even though I wasn't trying to be offensive. I was literally just giving, you know, my take on kind of what the changes were. Mm-hmm. And obviously there was a lot of criticism of the course that week, and Ernie took it very personally and was actually wanting to scrap on the reins the next morning.
Yeah.
And
you won't remember this, but I remember we walked off the 18th green. We'd started somewhere else. It wasn't our last hole, but we played the 18th hole as it was then. It's changed a little bit since.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to you, you know, what a terrible hole that is, Graham. And you went, well, what do you mean? I says, well, you're Graham McDowell and I'm me. And you and I had just played the hole in exactly the same way.
Uh-huh.
3-wood, 6
Yeah.
I should not be playing the hole the same way that you play it.
See, it was your fault. You got me in trouble there. You obviously planted that seed in my mind. Wentworth, they actually do have the course right now.
Yeah,
I mean, it took them a few goes, and obviously it wasn't just on Ernie. I think the GM or the owner at the time was having a little bit of an architectural influence that he maybe shouldn't have been having. And obviously Ernie ended up sort of, it was his name on it, and he got the flack a little bit, and guys were making 6s and 7s on that revamp. And
by
18.
The way, you don't want to mess with Ernie.
No, Ernie is a big lad that
if
you
comes
wouldn't
to fight. I'm betting on him.
I'm running fast, but so when the Wells Open at Celtic Manor, play unbelievable on the weekend. Go back to Orlando, have 4 or 5 days at home there. I think I played 9 holes with Ricky Elliott. I think I made like 7 birdies in 9 holes, just messing around with the lads. So, I mean, I was playing really, really well and flew out to Pebble. And Pete Cowan tells me that I looked him in the eye that week and told him that I had a big one in me. I don't actually remember saying it, but right. Pete's really kind of got a mind for that stuff. But I don't think I was ready. I didn't think it was going to be that weak. But there was something inside of me that was starting to brew, you know. And the U.S. Open had been my most successful major to that point. You know, I'd made some cuts at the U.S. Open. I'd competed a few times, and there was something in me that felt like I was a U.S. Open player. And obviously, Pebble was a surreal week. I played with Sean McKeel and Rocco Media the first 2 rounds. Played late on Thursday. Don't even remember what I shot. Don't even remember the round very well on Thursday afternoon. Friday morning, I remember I played well. I think I had a 2 or 3 shot lead that I slept on for, you know, probably 27 hours. You know, it was interesting watching the open there and Brian Harman and the late tee times. And it kind of just brought me back a little bit, you know, a guy that's never really led a major before. Led it from Friday morning all the way into Saturday afternoon. And I remember Saturday afternoon, teed off about 3:50 local time, played with Dustin Johnson, first time I'd played with him. And I mean, he shoots 66 on a firm, windy pebble, US Open pebble. And I walked off and I went, holy shit, who's this kid?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just like, I just saw the next superstar. And I mean, obviously he turned out, he was pretty good. And I remember Saturday was an incredibly nerve-wracking day for me, because I slept on that lead, and then all of a sudden I'd watched this absolute machine shoot what he shot. And I thought to myself, well, we're playing for second tomorrow. The pressure's off, you know? And I remember coming out, you know, Saturday was a much more comfortable evening for me. And I came out Sunday feeling a little bit better about myself, just confidence wise, because I felt like all eyes were on Dustin. I remember Kenny saying something to me on the range that morning, you know, because, you know, obviously I was still nervous. So just relative to the Saturday, I wasn't as nervous.
I can't believe you dismissed your chances completely.
Yeah, no. Of course, I was still going out there extremely competitive. I remember Kenny saying to me, Tiger was a group in front. I think Phil was a couple of groups in front of Tiger.
Andy was up there somewhere.
And Ernie was a couple of groups. I think he was a group in front of Tiger. So, I mean, you had 3 or 4 legends, you know, a few groups in front. And Kenny said to me, listen, you're going to probably hear some noise out there today. So just if you hear it, just know one thing. It's most likely a par putt. There's not going to be a lot of birdies out here. I mean, this place is so hard.
Did that suit you, your game?
It did. It suited me well. Yeah. I'm more of definitely more of a chess player than a checkers. Pebble that week was definitely chess. You know, I mean, we were hitting, you know, just for, you know, the par five, the sixth, we're hitting hybrid off the tee there. It was like an iron. It was literally like a racetrack.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
And, you know, it was very positional. It played very short. You had to be very conservative through iron play, playing to the front halves of greens, putting out to them. I putted great. You know, I think I was very good from inside 10 feet that week.
Imagine your long putting would be good that week.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, you had to pace putt well, even though the greens aren't particularly big at Pebble, obviously. But, you know, you had to hole a lot of 5, 6, 7 footers. And I did that really, really well that weekend. And, I mean, obviously Dustin makes 8 in the second and then doubles a third and ends up shooting 81 or something on Sunday. So, I mean, I stood in the third green. And then it was all back on me again. Yeah. I'm leading the Open again, the U.S. Open. Played great for about 8 holes. Bogey 9, bogey 10 from the middle of fairway. Kind of thought, holy shit, I'm letting this thing go here. Looked up at the leaderboard. Tiger's 2 over for the day. You know, Ernie's, you know, I'm like, well, I still had a 2-shot lead. I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
And that kind of refocused me. It was my first time looking at the leaderboard that day. Really focused me, it dialed me back in again, par 11, got it up and down from the front bunker on 12, par 13. And then 14 was kind of a weird one. I remember the par 5, Doug, like, right, I actually had a really good tee shot, but it's caught the last bunker right in the corner. Could only hack it out, left myself a 7-iron into the green, and I hit the 7-iron to 14.
It's a terrible green, that way.
Terrible. Yeah. And I mean, you know, the green ended up saving me in the end, but I hit the 7-iron in, and it was a top shelf 7-iron for me, and I remember hitting it going, Jesus, that was pretty good under the circumstances here. You know, reasonably nervous back 9 on Sunday at a major, and you just hit that shot. Okay. But I actually ran over the back. I putted it up the slope, and I hit it a little hard. So it went past, and it started heading off into that right half of that green where balls had been coming right off the front. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, my ball, I'd say a couple more revolutions, and it might went off the front. But it hung on. Mm-hmm. I made bogey. But I mean, that was huge because I could have made a number there.
And people did.
Guys were making numbers there.
Yeah.
And I remember hitting 2 great shots into the next. It's about 20 feet. Thought I made it. Actually, I walked it in. It lipped out. Par. Great 2-putt on 16 from long range. And then 1-shot lead standing on 17. And I started to probably get pretty nervous at that point. I pretty much laid the sod over the 5-iron on 17.
Right.
17 was unplayable.
Yeah.
It was downwind. The
green's ridiculous. It was
downwind, and it was to left pin. And I knew if I flew this 5-iron on the green that I might not be able to hold the green, and over the back was dead.
Yeah.
So you were kind of like basically trying to pitch it just over the front bunker, and if it went in the front bunker, it was an okay leave. I think I one-hopped into the bunker. I hit it so badly. So I ended up in the front bunker, which was an okay leave, and I think I had an average trap shot. I missed about an 8-footer. So I made bogey there, and Havray had just made bogey in front. So it's Havray and Tiger in front, and you've
given away the great trivia question.
Yeah, exactly.
Who was second?
Yeah. There's a funny story in that here in a second. But so Havray and Tiger are the group in front, and Havray ends up being the guy that comes close. So he bogeyed 17 as well. So I know I've got a 1-shot lead playing 18, but 18 was playing short. They had the tee forward. 2 trees in the middle of fairway. We all know Pebble, famous left side, no good. Couple of trees in the middle of the fairway. And my game plan that week was if the tee was in the back, the trees were in a really bad spot for me because I couldn't get past them. So I was laying back and playing it as a 3-shotter if it was on the back tee.
Yeah.
But they pushed it forward. And my game plan from the forward tee was we're going past the trees. So there was no layup. There was no let's try and play 5 to win here. It was like, you know, I'm hitting driver. I hit a pretty good one. And I was in the right semi, about 230 flag, I think. And I could see Havre up, and he's hit it in the right bunker in 2. So it was kind of, you know, it was getting dusky, you know, and I could just, you know, I saw him hit his trap shot and couldn't really see the ball. We're listening for the crowd. We're like, they like it, but I'm not sure they love it. Mm. And obviously it was about 8 feet, 10 feet, and he missed it. And then at that point, you know, it's 5 to win from 230 yards. Kenny wanted me to go for it. Him and I still argue about this to this day. He wanted me to just bunt a hybrid up beside the green somewhere.
Yeah.
And I did not like the shot at all. All I could see was trouble. All I could see was left bunker, the tree that sits just short right of the green. If you squirt one, you don't leave yourself a chip. I didn't want to go. He ended up let me lay it up. But he argues to this day that it was the other way around, that I wanted to go. Yeah, but
ironically, given what we talked about earlier, I think the 18th at Pebble is actually a better hole when you guys can reach it.
Yeah.
No, it's certainly more interesting, it's more fun to watch.
It's a great hole.
Because it's a 100-yard par three otherwise.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the problem. You get par fives that, you know, we played one in Bedminster last week, the 18th hole. And, I mean, it's a wonderful two-shotter, and it's a horrendous three-shotter. You know, and like you say, it ends up just being a par three. Guys all led up to the same spot and going, well, wedge, nine iron. So, you know, I love 18 at Pebble. I think it's, you know, it's an iconic finishing hole. And, you know, I led it up to my favorite number, which is 100 yards, and hit a pretty good little wedge shot in there. I remember having 25 feet, two putts to win. And I remember, like, you know, Gregory Havery, I mean, no disrespect to him, but I remember thinking to myself over the putt, at least if I three putt this, I'm in a playoff and I think I can handle Gregory tomorrow.
But you're right.
But it was one of those weird thoughts that popped into my head, and it kind of took the pressure off me. It was weird, you know, and I wiggled it down there to about 16 inches, 18 inches. And, you know, my dad always said that the back of the green sits just a little lower and couldn't quite see up over the top. And he saw Kenny starting to unscrew the flag, so he knew it was pretty close.
Yeah.
But like I say, that was a weird thought. Gregory's a good friend. And yeah, but I just remember thinking, well, I think I can maybe win the playoff tomorrow.
Yeah. I have one last question for you, Graham, before we wind this up. What happened to the cardigans?
The cardies.
You're not wearing a cardigan today. What's going on?
Yeah, the cardigans.
Where did that start?
I was buying golf shirts from Gabici, Italian company. Okay. And I started getting a few bits of knitwear from them. I've always been a fan of, you know, I mentioned the Pringle sweaters early in the chat, and I've always been a fan of fine knitwear.
Yeah.
And they started sending me these cardigans, and I started wearing them, and obviously got a decent bit of feedback on them. And I was a wee bit slimmer in those days, and I think I could pull it off a bit better. But it was definitely an interesting look that weekend. And obviously, Pebble Beach in June with a, you know, bit of ocean breeze can be a bit chilly, you know. So it was definitely a cardigan kind of day on that Sunday afternoon, and it definitely added to the. Added to the vibe a little bit, shall we say. But no, I don't. Actually, not even sure I physically own a cardigan. I do, actually. I do have a.
Don't tell me that.
I have a few. That's lies, actually. Yeah. I do have a few, but it's been a long time since I wore one on the golf course, I got to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, I miss them for what it's worth.
I'll bring them back.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and shed a bit of timber and bring them back.
Yeah. Anyway, Graham, thank you for your time. It's been a fascinating chat. Hope you've enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, it's been great. No, I appreciate it, John. Good to see you, man.
Thanks.
I reckon Huggy got it right in the intro there, an extremely engaging and interesting talker and thinker on the game. Big thanks to Graham McDowell for taking the time to sit down and chat. Well, as mentioned at the start, it is the run-up to the Ryder Cup, and next week it's a special episode and special guest when Huggy sits down with 8-time player and 3-time European Ryder Cup captain Bernard Gallagher.
Yeah, tell me what the vice captain does.
Well, exactly. Tell me what I do, because I wasn't privy to what went on in the team room like it is today.
You weren't in the team room?
No, absolutely not. And, I never saw that as my position. Tony called me a vice captain when he came to the end of his captaincy. But I never really felt I was anything more than a helper driving his buggy.
That's next time on The Thing About Golf.